This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Sam Lau here with my co-host, Eric Dahl.
Hey, hey, hey.
All right. We're recording today just after the close on May the 5th. And for those of you who are joining us live today via the Twitter Spaces, happy Cinco de Mayo, everyone. And that goes out to you as well, Dahl, of course. For those of you who aren't familiar, just per the Wikipedia here, I pulled it up and it says that Cinco de Mayo in Mexico, which is Spanish for 5th of May, is an annual celebration of Mexico's victory over the Second French Empire at the Battle of Puebla in 1862, led by General Ignacio Zaragoza. The victory over the French army was a morale boost for the Mexicans. And sometimes Cinco de Mayo is mistaken for Mexico's Independence Day, which is actually the most important national holiday in Mexico. But that day is celebrated on September the 16th. So Cinco de Mayo, everyone, let's go out there and give some further morale boosting out there with something that's affectionately known here in LA, at least, as Cinco de Drinko. So with that, we got a pretty heavy calendar for the agenda today. I'll kick us off with where we are from the macro front. From the markets perspective. So, for the week ending May 5th, 2023, the S&P 500 ended down 78 basis points, but still is up a whopping 8.3% on the first 5 months of the or first after the first 4 months of the year here, plus 5 days. Leading the way are the three positive performers for the week. Technology as the sector, up 30 basis points, utilities up 10 basis points, and healthcare up about 10 basis points as well. The laggards here are all three of them are down in excess of 2.5%. You got comm services and financials each down about 2.5%. And then you have the energy sector leading the way down. That's down 5.7% on the week. It looks like the move to this week, based on the technologies being up and communication services being down, put them pretty much neck to neck on the year-to-date basis, each up and being the best performers, best performing sectors within the S&P 500 at a positive 22% on the year-to-date basis. Moving over to fixed income land, a little bit of a mixed bag here. The two-year Treasury rallied a bit this week, with the two-year note yield dropping 10 basis points to 3.91%. The 10-year Treasury note is pretty much flat at 3.43% yield, and the bond is up about 7 basis points to 3.75% to close this week here. So with that type of move with the yield curve, we saw a de-inversion kind of trend continuing with the 2s-10 spread. The differential between those two points of the Treasury curve ended this week at negative 0.48 basis points, or 0.48 percentage points, I should say, negative 48 basis points there. So what that meant for the broad basket of fixed income, as measured by the Bloomberg U.S. Bond Aggregate, that was down about 5 basis points on a week-to-date basis, but it's still holding on to a positive year-to-date performance of 3.75%. A little bit of mixed bag here within the fixed income cohorts that we look at when it comes to the sectors. You got the bookends here within the constituents of the Bloomberg aggregate with both agency MBS and treasuries with the loan positive performers with regards to the sectors this week. Agency MBS up 20 basis points and treasuries up about 10 basis points. On the other bookend there, we have IG corporate credits down almost 1% for the week-to-date basis. But IG corporate credit is still the best performer within the various sectors that we look at, up about 4.25% on the year-to-date basis. Moving over to commodities, the broad basket of commodities as measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Index was down 1.2% for the week, and that brought the year-to-date performance down to negative 7.2% for the year-to-date basis. WTI crude oil, despite having a pretty decent move today, couldn't get out of its own way. It's down 7% on the week-to-date basis. It closed today at a level of $71.35 per barrel of WTI front month contracts there. So it is below the point at which OPEC made that announcement over a surprise weekend announcement that they would be cutting supply. That Friday leading into that announcement, WTI crude oil had ended up the day at $75.67. So we are about $4 below that level now. Kind of makes you think about it, Dahl, where we would be if OPEC had not made that announcement. We'd probably be somewhere in the six handles. But with that, on a year-to-date basis, the front month contract WTI crude oil futures is down 11%. On the flip side, we have gold up 11% positive for the year-to-date basis. It did manage to close the week above the 2000 mark, $2,025 per troy ounce about, making it up 1.5% on the week-to-date basis. And then to round this all out with Bitcoin closed just a little bit below the $30,000 a coin mark. It's up about 50 basis points on the week, up a whopping 78% on the year-to-date basis there. So with that market roundup over, Dahl, do you want to kick us off on what happened in macro land this past week?
Absolutely. So Monday, May 1st, was a pretty interesting day because over the weekend we had a bank failure. Can't mention names for compliance reasons, but I think everybody's aware they used to give out green umbrellas. We had the ISM manufacturing print for April come in at 47.1, which was 0.3 above the estimate of 46.8. But due to that said failure, we really, you know, I think most of the market moves were driven by the banking stress. On Tuesday, May the 2nd, we had the JOLTS job opening information come out. And some people think that data survey isn't as relevant because right now the participation rate's only about 31%. It's fallen to about 31%. But nonetheless, came in at 9,590,000, which was a drop of 146K. And alluding to Wednesday, the Chairman Powell actually mentioned it. There's 1.64 job openings to unemployed right now. So really, the labor market's still out of balance from the Federal Reserve's perspective, where you have a surplus of jobs relative to people out there, and that's giving strength to the labor market and strength to wage growth, which we'll see later in the week. Wednesday, we had the ADP unemployment change, and that's another indicator some people don't really think too much of, but came in at 296K, which was a big beat, 146,000 above expectations. And that kind of was a prelude to what we saw today in the jobs numbers. Wednesday was Fed Day, which is the topic of the week, which we'll really dissect. But if you haven't heard, the Federal Reserve increased interest rates by 0.25 percentage point to 5.25. And we're really going to dig into that in topic of the week. So I'll leave it there for now. We also had the ISM services for April come out at 51.9, which was 0.1 above the estimate. Thursday, we had initial jobless claims, and that was really nothing to report. Came in at 242K, which was 2,000 above estimates. And continuing claims similarly was right in line with expectations at 1.8 million. And then looking to today, we had some big news come out. The change in non-farm payrolls for April was pretty incredible. Well, I don't know about incredible. Let's just say it was a double, if using baseball lingo. 253,000, which was 68,000 more than the estimate. The unemployment rate dropped down to its low of January, 3.4%, declining 0.2% from the previous of 3.6%, the estimate of 3.6%. And the labor force participation rate remains static. So this job market's not really pulling any new labor force participants into the market. I think another thing of note that's important is average hourly earnings on a year-over-year basis came in at 4.4%, which is an increase from the prior 4.2%. So definitely strength in the labor market, strength in wages, still 1.6 job openings per job candidate, and really just going to be waiting for the I think the CEO of Double Line, Jeffrey Gundlach, was on CNBC, and his interview will be up today, actually, on Double Line's media. But great interview. But I think he mentioned, you know, there's multiple things going on. The Fed is tightening. We have banking stress, which could lead to a credit contraction, and we have quantitative tightening. And that trifecta hasn't really stopped the labor market. The momentum is incredible. So we'll see what happens. But I think that right now, the Fed is in a tough spot. And as long as the labor market remains as strong as it is, they are going to have to stay tight in order to try and strangle out inflation.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice of word there, trifecta, which almost sounds like it has a positive connotation there. But in the context of what you're saying there, on top of the strangulation hold that you applied there to the market, it's an interesting choice of words. But this, you know, the strong labor data that came out today does give Powell some more food for thought, I suppose, Powell and his colleagues in terms of their June meeting coming out in 6 weeks coming up. So we'll stay tuned for that. After that, I think we still have, given that this came out the first week of May, I think we still have two more payroll and jobs data before they go to bat again with their June meeting for the FOMC. Speaking of which, in Fed speak, we also had Bullard come out today. I think Mayberry had mentioned that today was the first day of the ending of the blackout. So, of course, James Bullard came out and today made the statement that he does think that the Fed can still achieve a soft landing and also bring inflation to the Fed's 2% target without really triggering a significant downturn. He didn't think that the U.S. would need to see a surge in unemployment in order to cool inflation. So he's sounding pretty optimistic about their policy as it stands right now. He did say that it's possible that, of course, I mean, it's good to see that he acknowledges this, but he does say that, yes, the economy could go into recession, but that's not the base case. And I think the base case that he stated was one of slow growth, which coincides with what Powell said during the press conference, I believe in the Q&A portion. But the Bullard also did allude to the fact that there probably will be a somewhat softer labor force and declining alongside that declining inflation. So we'll take a look and see if his base case is correct. But moving over to the topic of the week, today was this week was Fed week, Fed day on this past Wednesday, May 3rd. Inside of the statement and the decision, we saw the FOMC increase the overnight target rate from 4.75% on the lower bound and 5% on the upper bound. They moved it up by a quarter point. So now the range is now 5% to 5.25% on the upper and lower. They also, with that, moved in tandem with the interest on reserves up to 4.15%. And also the rate that's paid on the overnight reverse repo, that was moved up to 5.05%. They did leave the amount, the cap of that each counterparty can access at the window to, and they left that at $160 billion. For those of you who are interested, Mayberry and I had done a podcast recently on April 21st, 2023, where Jeff and I talk a little bit about the interest on excess, or sorry, not the interest on excess reserves anymore, but the interest on reserves, as well as the overnight reverse repo function and how those policy tools, what role they play in trying to keep the effective Fed funds rate between the upper and lower bound range. So, and why it's important for them to move that alongside their decision when they make on the Fed funds target ranges there. So that was episode 112, recorded on April 21st, 2023. You should be able to find it on any of your favorite podcast platforms or on the Double Line website as well. And they did leave the amount of the quantitative tightening program with regards to the reduction in holdings of treasuries and MBS unchanged over the last meeting at 60 billion for treasuries cap, as well as a 35 billion cap on agency mortgage-backed securities. So moving on from the statement and that it was released, moving into the actual presser with the prepared remarks, in reading the transcript there, I had a couple takeaways there where, you know, that I noted. First off, it's always interesting to see what Jerome Powell starts out his statement with. And this time he started out the presser directly acknowledging the banking system. And he said that conditions in the banking sector have generally improved since early March. Those listeners would recall that March 8th was the day that, was it Silvergate? Shuttered voluntarily, so I guess it's not considered a failure, but they did close their doors on March 8th, and then we had an involuntary bank failure on March 10th, and then March 12th in the form of SVB and then Signature Banks, so every other day beginning that March 8th. So overall, he says that the conditions have improved for the banking sector, and he said that the U.S. banking system is, quote, sound and resilient, end quote there. So that remains to be seen. We did see some more pressures along the regional banks. In fact, as I pulled it up here, let me take a look. The regional banking index, the S&P regional banking index, was down 8% this week, and there were a couple of names in there that did seem to have quite a bit more market stress and may not have believed what Jerome Powell statement on the sound and resilient there. So we'll continue to monitor that, Eric, and inform our listeners as you know the news develops there. He also, in his prepared remarks, acknowledged the slow and below trend economic growth that continues to be seen in the economy. And he also acknowledged that the activity in the housing sector remained weak. And that was largely due to the higher interest rates and slower output growth that seems to be weighing in on business fixed income, business fixed investment as well. But the counterpoint to that was that he says that the labor market, as you pointed out, remains very tight. And he also did bring up his ratio of job openings to the number of employed remaining high, as you mentioned as well. Also, he did say that while inflation has moderated somewhat since the middle of last year, nonetheless, inflation pressures, they continue to run high, and the process of getting inflation back down to the 2% target rate still has a long way to go. There were some positives in there as well, though. He did say that despite elevated levels of inflation, longer-term expectations for inflation appear to me remain well anchored. And that was something that he had mentioned several meetings ago as part of his rationale for continuing along the aggressive rate hike policy, was that longer term expectations. I believe he mentioned specifically the survey put out by the University of Michigan showing that it had moved up. But as you know, you, me, and Jeff have talked about on this podcast over the course of the year, a lot of times these surveys are just, people just put fingers up to the air and they don't quite know exactly. I mean, if you were to ask me again what I think inflation will be at the end of this year, I can barely tell you, let alone, 5 years from what it'll be 5 years from now. And that was one of the points that Powell had referenced in that press conference a few months back. So I would presume that he's still talking about those surveys here, both the University of Michigan as well as the one that's put out by the conference board for that statement there.
Yeah, on that point, I mean, we're going to get some of that information next Friday, May 12th. And so that could be something to watch, at least to try and get into the psyche of Jerome Powell.
Yeah, the man of mystery, at least his ambiguous definitions that he gives to terms like transitory. But then, just as he kind of began the presser with talking about the banking sector, he also closed his prepared remarks with another statement on the banks again. And here he said that the economy is likely to face further headwinds from tighter credit conditions, which had already been tightening in response to the monetary policy, as well as broadly weaker economic outlook that many Americans have. His observation there is that the banking situation also appears to be resulting in even tighter credit conditions for households and businesses. And all of this will continue to weigh on the economy and inflation numbers, but the extent of these effects remain uncertain. So those are the prepared remarks that Powell had before starting with the Q&A. Scrubbing through the transcript, we pulled out a couple of highlights from the Q&A. One of the questions there was that regarding a pause, you know, there was a change in the statement for those people that like to really parse through the language and the words in the prepared press release statement. And one of the journalists in the room had asked that if they should read that statement today as a pause in interest rate increases at the June meeting. So Powell very clearly said that a decision on the pause was not made today. And instead, they'll always be data dependent. So again, there's another 6 weeks before the next meeting. A lot of data comes out between then. So they did not make a decision on a pause. He did acknowledge that there was the change in the FOMC statement. And previously on March 22nd, there was language in there that said, quote, the committee anticipates that some additional policy firming may be appropriate, end quote. And then in this most recent statement, he said, or they said that in determining the extent to which additional policy firming may be appropriate to return inflation to 2% over time. So it was really that change from anticipating some policy firming, additional policy firming, changing it to in determining the extent to which additional policy firming may be appropriate. So slight changes, little nuances in words, but as we like to say on the desk there, words do matter. Another question.
Yeah, I mean, it gets a little micro analytical, right? I mean, it's like Fed exegesis. It almost becomes like a scriptural analysis of the Federal Reserve's policy. But the market is implying that the Fed's going to start cutting in September or November of this year. So we'll see if that comes to pass.
Yeah. And you know, I was thinking the same thing as I was reading through the transcript, but it was interesting to me later on that Powell does acknowledge that not only in this answer, but in a subsequent answer as well, the fact that he wanted to draw journalists and you know listeners' attention to the fact that these little nuanced word changes are indicative of how they are thinking. So another question that I found interesting was that someone had asked that the Fed staff had revised their forecast for recession, which had been stated as a mild recession at the last March meeting, which coincides with their quarterly release of their summary of economic projections. And Powell said that's not his own base case. He made it clear that his differs from the rest of the Fed staff, but that's not his own base case. And his base case was that really that the economy will continue to grow at a modest rate this year. So that kind of sounds like a base case of almost no landing to me that, again, seemed to be echoed by James Bullard, sorry, today at his panel discussion that he had today. There was a question about debt limit here, and Powell basically, as he should, said, that's not my purview. That's not something that is decided by me. That's an issue for the fiscal side of things, really. I mean, it's a congressional issue, and it's not a monetary issue. But he did add, and this is a perhaps you know people in Congress should take note that, quote, it's essential that the debt ceiling be raised in a timely manner so that the U.S. government can pay all of its bills when they're due. The consequences to the U.S. economy would be highly uncertain and could be quite adverse. So hopefully that's just a statement of the obvious to those power makers in Congress there, but they've been told. Another question here was that, let's see, someone asked if they could tell us what the Federal Reserve Board did in the wake of the February presentation where the members were informed that Silicon Valley Bank and other banks were experiencing interest rate risks. And this is where Powell kind of danced around a lot here. He did mention that there was one page within the entire presentation on Silicon Valley Bank, which they talked about, and it did point out that there was a amount of, you know, a larger amount of potential mark-to-market losses that they had in the portfolio. He went on to say that there's nothing that he recalled about the risk of a bank run. The takeaway there was that they're going to be doing a horizontal assessment of banks, and that it, in the presentation, it wasn't presented as something that was urgent or even an alarming situation. It was more or less presented as something that was informational and a non-decisional kind of thing. He tried to close up that question at that point by saying that he thought it was a good presentation. And I believe it was Steve Leisman that asked the question. He wouldn't let him end it with that, the fact that, you know, Powell thought it was a good presentation. He had a follow-up question that said that the staff report said that SVB had significant interest rate risk. It said interest rate risk measurements failed at SVB, and it said banks with large unrealized losses face significant safety and soundness risks. And Leisman goes on to ask, why was that not alarming? To which Powell responded that in the presentation, it was mentioned that they had taken regulatory action on matters requiring attention and that they're on the case. Not much meat or substance there, so not too much comfort that I grabbed from that response. But again, as we mentioned earlier, we'll just continue to monitor this as it goes along. But certainly there is a reason for the stress that's occurring within the regional banking sector as a result of the policy, that monetary policy that the Fed has embarked upon there, just given the differential in rates, definitely adding stress to that portion of the financial markets.
Another question. I think one thing to that point, Mr. Powell mentioned that when he got back, when he got involved in the government years ago, there were 14,000 banks, and now there's 4,000. And he just kind of had this emotional sentiment that it's okay for these banks to fail and for consolidation to occur. But I don't know if they're taking it seriously enough, or if he's just trying to have a strong poker face for the markets.
Yeah, which is important. I guess you have to display some form of confidence out there, given, you know, what was going on in the backdrop in markets, specifically in the regional banking sector at that time, while he was speaking, and shortly and the next day after, particularly with a couple of the other banks, specific banks there. Let's see here. Just a few more questions that we thought were interesting. Someone asked about a prolonged period of 3% inflation. Would he be okay with that? And Powell's answer on that was just no. Basically, I thought it was funny. He started out his answer with look. And anytime I hear someone begin an answer with look, it just always has that feel of exasperation or frustration to me. But he said, look, I think we're going to have 2% as our target. We're always going to have, 2% as our target. And we're always going to be focusing on getting there. We're not looking for inflation to go down to we're looking for inflation to go down to 2% over time. We're not looking to get to 3% and then to drop our policy tools there. He was also asked what his policy reaction function is going forward, which type of indicators he'd be looking at, and to which he listed the regular suspects of readings on inflation, wages, economic growth, as well as the labor market. But then he went on to add that he thinks a particular focus for them going forward is going to be what's happening with credit tightening. Are small and medium-sized banks, the regional banks, going to be tightening their credit standards? And is that going to have effect on loans and lending? So, you know, definitely some focuses needs to be spent there and seeing how it impacts their monetary policy as they continue to embark on that journey. Because we, again, as many people, you know, like to, you know, not necessarily forget about, but it's rarely mentioned, is the quantitative tightening that goes on in the background that continues to grind away to the tune of a cap of 60 and 35 on treasuries and agency MBS, as well as what we see in the, even if we have a pause in rate hikes, it's still at a very elevated rate. To which the next question was, what about rate cuts? And Powell's answer is that their view, the Fed, the FOMC, their view is that inflation is going to come down, but it's not going to come down quickly, and it's going to come down over time. And if that forecast is right, then it wouldn't be appropriate to cut rates. But if they had a different forecast for rapid reduction in inflation, then they'd have to factor that in. But right now, that's not their forecast at all. And with that, I think those were the some of the bigger takeaways. Did you have anything that you wanted to add there for from the press conference, Dahl?
I think that on your last point there, one of the things that the Fed's really worried about is kind of core services inflation. And it's going to be tough for the interest rate hikes to really address that issue until they start seeing some contraction in the labor market. So that's really the spot the Fed is in. And I don't know if they have the real policy tools to do anything except wait and see if the data starts to turn their way.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. And it just makes me think of also just this other question that came up and where he was asked, Powell was asked on the impact that the overnight reverse repo would be having in terms of the current banking stress. And he said that his answer was that they looked at that situation very carefully, and he just doesn't think that's contributing, at least for now. So it's just one of those things, again, where you end up reaping what you sow. And what we've embarked upon is this quantitative, or this experiment of quantitative easing that really began post GFC, and they've just been adding more and more monetary tools, policy tools to really address the situation that they created themselves, of which the standing overnight reverse repo facility is also a new entrant into their toolbox of monetary policy tools. But with that, sorry, Eric, do you want to kick us off on the things to keep an eye on next week within the macro lane?
Definitely. We'll hit the turbos. You know, we appreciate you listeners. We don't want to keep you too long. So I think the biggest things to look out for next week are going to be on Wednesday. We get CPI for April, and that's a very important indicator. Naturally, the Fed's looking at it. The markets are looking at it. It's going to be a market mover potentially. The CPI year over year for April is estimated to be at 5.0%, which is in line with the prior, while the CPI ex food and energy, the core year over year number for April, is expected to be 5.5%, a decrease of 0.1%. And we'll see what it comes in at. Month over month, the CPI is expected to be 0.4%. which is actually an increase of 0.3% from the prior. And the core CPI month over month is expected to come in at 0.3%, a decrease of 0.1% from the prior. On Thursday, we have the initial jobless claims come out, expect to be 245,000. Nothing really to see there, steady as she drifts. But we also get the PPI for April. And the PPI final demand year over year is expected to come in at 2.4%, a decrease from the prior of 0.3%. And the core PPI is anticipated to come in at 3.3%, a decrease of 0.1% from the prior. On Friday, as alluded to previously on this podcast, we get the University of Michigan sentiment data, the May prelims, and that's something to watch. I think it'll be interesting because clearly the Federal Reserve is looking at it. But as Sam pointed out, you know, who really knows? This is kind of just a finger in the air sort of a survey, but it is something the Fed watches to see if inflation expectations are anchored for the longer term. We also get a data point that at Double Line we like to look at because there aren't hedonic adjustments. We get the import price index for April comes in on Friday, and that's expected to decline 4.8%, which is a 0.2% decrease from the prior reading, which was also negative. So that wraps it up for the information coming out next week. Some important data points to watch.
Yeah, and I'll just layer on a couple more things here. Since the blackout period is over for the Fed, we'll have to listen to the tone of the Fed talking heads as they come out over the course of the next few days and weeks. But next week, some of the things that stand out, looks like Williams is going to be speaking on, let me see, what is that date? 5-9 is on May the 9th, which is a Tuesday. And then we have Waller on Thursday coming out to speak. And then we have San Francisco Fed President, Mary Daly, coming out. But then again, I see here that she's just giving a commencement speech. So she's probably not going to talk about her role in the SVB saga there and so and what they saw with the Signature Bank, or not Signature, but I would say Silvergate in that region there, as she's the San Francisco Fed representative there. And then we also have Bullard and Jefferson on Friday as well. So quite a bit of Fed speakers out there, so we can check the tone and take the pulse at next week's Monday morning minutes there. But I think that wraps us up there. I want to thank everyone for tuning in with us live here on Twitter Spaces, as well as to those of you who are catching us on the podcast platform as well.
Yeah, thanks to all of you listeners out there today on Monday Morning Minutes. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can pick up the latest episode on Monday before the bell or live on Twitter Spaces after the close. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Hit us up on Twitter at DL Minutes and send us your questions, or you can send us an email at minutes@doubleline.com, and we'll try and integrate that into future episodes.
Yeah, don't forget that you can find more information about Double Line at our website, doubleline.com. Please also don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/DoubleLineCapital. And as Dahl had mentioned, well, we do have Jeffrey Gundlach's recent post-FOMC thoughts with the judge over at CNBC. That should be coming up later today. And I'm also told that we should expect Kenny Shinoda's Channel 11 posting on that same YouTube channel, and where he gives his April review, and that should be posting out on Monday. And then finally, you can follow me and Sherman on the Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. We should be having our new episode drop next Thursday as well. So stay tuned for that. Hope everyone has a great week and good luck out there.
Happy Cinco de Mayo, everybody.
Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.